Thank you for coming. It is my pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight. His name is David Chevalier. He first, at least as far as the connection with our group, shared his experience to Arvin Gibson, who was one of the original founders of this group. I found that description absolutely fascinating. He works for the Forest Service and has a position with the union, and so he's all over the place nationally in connection with his job. His near-death experience happened on Friday the 13th in November of 1981, and it's a very dramatic experience. I'll turn the time over to David Chevalier. It's such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's something I didn't ever expect to get a call out of from nowhere to say, hey, come talk about your experience. I told Martin when he got a hold of me, I'm more than happy to do so. I will say that for many years I kept it to myself because there are so many doubting Thomases out there that they want to try to discount what happened. My injury was so traumatic that, of course, the drugs that they had me on were, let's say, mind-altering. A lot of people who don't understand what's really going on in the human mind, it's interference. Anyway, I'll give you a little background and work up on what happened. I was working for the railroad as a heavy equipment operator, and the day before the winter layoff, a buddy of mine was driving home after the end of the day, fell asleep at the wheel, went in the ditch, had a rollover, and passed away. I don't like to attend funerals, but this guy was a close enough friend that the day after layoff, a number of us who got laid off decided we'd all go to his funeral. So I stopped by my grandmother's farm that morning, Friday the 13th, 1981, all dressed up, ready to go to a funeral, you know, wearing your church clothes. And one of my relatives who, I think everybody's got a black sheep in the family, don't you? At least one. Well, this particular one was, he was an alcoholic, unemployed, had a number of problems. He got up that morning and he was going to take it out on the world one way or another. And I just happened to be there. And my background and experience prior to working for the railroad is I had been a military policeman for the United States Army. And so I had been trained in good law enforcement techniques and background. After I got out of the Army, I went to work for the Sheriff's Department and was a deputy sheriff for 2 years of my life. But after a number of fatality accidents where children were involved, I said, I can't do this, and had to walk away. But I had a lot of experience in law enforcement, so when this individual, this family member, whose name I never mentioned because why should I give him any credence for what he did, started to go off the deep end, I was the only one that could stand up and intervene so that no one else got hurt and tried to control the situation. And it was coming under control as far as I was concerned, and then he stormed out of the room. Well, I went back to talking to my grandmother and cousin at the kitchen table. He came around the kitchen door with a shotgun and at hip level pulled the trigger. Hit me right here. And we were so close, the end of the shotgun was just about where you are, sir, from me. So if you know anything about shotguns, the round didn't have a chance to open up until it went inside me, and then it went everywhere. I'm not supposed to be here. Everything I ever knew about you getting shot with a shotgun, especially a 12-gauge at close range, you die. There's like an equal sign. You get shot with a shotgun, equals death, period. That's it. But survival instinct being what it was, the moment I came back to realization, because when you get hit with something that traumatic, there's a black period in your life. You can't recapture it. The brain won't let you recapture it. It's a blackout zone that you're not going to remember. But I instantly came back, saw him at the other side of the table. It was a center break shotgun. He had opened it and was reloading to come around and finish me off. And survival instinct being what it was, I came up off the floor, which kind of surprised him, and grabbed a hold of that shotgun around the butt and the barrel and fought him over it. And he realized then he'd done something wrong. let go of the shotgun, and we both dropped it. Thinking back on it, I may have just picked it up and used it myself, but that's a whole other story. The next thing that hit me was I knew I was going to die. I really knew I was going to die. So what do you do when you're going to die? I instantly started praying and repenting for my sins, because if I was going out, I wanted a clean slate. But while I was praying, a voice came into my head, and if you've ever heard yourself on a tape recorder, it sounded like that. It was me, but it wasn't me. The voice said, this is a quote, "Call 911, stupid, you might live." And so I'm in the living room. The phone's right there at my grandmother's. I went and called 911 and talked to the paramedics and just dropped the phone, and then the couch was there. And all that Army medical training that I had gotten and the basic EMT stuff that I had gotten in the law enforcement came back like programming in my head. It started running like a program. Treat for shock. Don't look at the wound. Stop the bleeding. All this stuff came back online. I remember putting my hand over the hole and pulling it away, and there was a red outline. Not a solid meatball, just a red outline, so I knew I was bleeding internally. So I got on the couch, elevated my feet. I was in my Sunday best, relaxed, and took my tie off and continued to pray. And it seemed like mere moments, but of course I was, you know, focusing on the fact that I wanted to go out clean with a clean slate. But the paramedics came through the door. They were there instantly providing treatment. The detectives showed up, found him. They put the balloon pants on me to keep blood shoved up into my upper cavity, keep me conscious, got into the EMT van, and we were on our way to the hospital. And I'll always remember the poor EMT that had a hold of me. I was holding his hand, and he says, you hold my hand as tight as you need to and hold on to me. That poor son of a gun. I don't know if I had to have crushed his fingers because I was holding on so tight. But we got to the emergency room. I couldn't believe it. They roll me in. The nurses that are in the emergency room want me to fill out the paperwork. Are you kidding me? And that's what I said. Are you kidding me? And the nurse said, okay, I'll fill it out. Just tell me what I need to know. And so we got to my name. This happened months later after I had a chance to see her and I'd been through this whole thing. She says, I remember you. And this is the reason she remembered me. She said, can you spell your last name? I said, C-H-E-V-A-L-I-E-R, and don't screw it up on the death certificate. Because so many people had screwed up my name over the years. But anyway, we got all the paperwork done. They got ready to roll me out. They released the air on the pants, and that was it. Darkness. I don't remember a thing until I was in the intensive care room. They had me on oxygen machine. There were tubes running in and out of me. I was stapled together down my entire abdomen, and I was trying to figure out what in the heck was going on, where I was at, and trying to cope, and had a little bit of disbelief that I was still here. But I remember looking to my right a little bit, and my dad's sitting next to me, and I'm going, wow, I've been out a long time. He lives in Arizona, and this had happened in Iowa. So he had managed to get on a plane, fly back there, get to the hospital, and all that time I had been out. They had me in surgery for 8.5 hours. I went through 27 units of blood. They lost me on the operating table, and they brought me back. That was number one, because it happens 3 times. They cracked me open from the sternum down below the belt line, opened me up, and the doctor said, or the surgeon told me later, I was on one gurney, and they brought another one up, and they took all of my entrails and laid them out on the other table. And they went through and cut out all the pieces they couldn't use anymore and put everything back together. It must have been a very interesting puzzle when it got done. But they got me put back together and moved me into recovery, and they lost me again. And they brought me back again. They took me to the ICU, and I got all hooked up. And all of this is kind of foggy, you have to understand. One, it's tough understanding what's going on. But when you're a guy who wears glasses and they haven't put them back on your face, I mean, on top of the fuzz that you're going through because of the injury, but not to be able to see, it was like a dream state. But while I was in intensive care, I woke up one night and I had this thirst. I mean, it was a killer thirst. And I thought, this is a hospital room. There's got to be something to drink. And I looked around, and there were no pitchers or nothing, anything like that. And then I saw this bottle sitting next to the bed that said purified water. And I just grabbed a hold of it and started drinking. You don't do that with a stomach wound. The nurse came in, and oh, geez, you could tell she was flipped out because I started to bleed out immediately when that happened. And that's when they lost me a third time. On that third time, I had, for lack of any other way to describe it, an out-of-body experience. I'm laying in the gurney here, and yet my point of vision is as if I'm standing. And there's a doctor and nurse on this side of the bed, and there's a nurse at the end of the bed. This nurse is reading off my blood pressure. She says, I've got 60 over 20. Wait a minute, I've got 60 over 0. And the doctor turns to the nurse at the end of the bed and says, you better get the family and the clergy. And that voice I was telling you before about that sounds like it's on a tape recorder, I heard it again in my head, and it was, no, I'm not ready yet. And when that hit me, the nurse on this side of the bed said, wait a minute, I've got 80 over 20, I've got 80 over 30, and I blacked out again. Now, for the longest time, I was in blackness. But then, on the right side of the bed, and I'm no longer having this out-of-body experience, I'm seeing this from my gurney. On the left side of my bed appears my Savior. And he's like every picture I've ever seen or imagined that he looks like. And he's running his hands up and down my chest. And all of the staples and all of the stitching and all of the tubes are disappearing. And then he puts out his hand, and I reached out and I touched his hand. And the minute I did, we were standing on the rim of this incredibly gorgeous valley with a mountain scene in the background, running water, green pastures, trees, clouds. It was so magnificent, I can't fully, and I've never been fully able to describe it, but if you've ever been at Zion on a gorgeous day, it's like that. And the reality factor was, if for those of us who have white, little, or no hair, you remember when you used to be able to turn up the contrast and make the picture even sharper? That's what it was like. This thing was crystal clear, and I didn't need these at all. It was absolutely beautiful. And in this valley were people, all in white, milling around. But you know when you're in a crowd, whether you're at a sports event or you're at a concert, how you can get a feel for the crowd, if there's anticipation or that kind of thing. There was an overwhelming sense from all of the people there of anticipation. And so I turned to my Savior, and I said, what are we waiting for? And he turned to me, and the second he opened his mouth, I was back in intensive care. All of the tubes had reappeared, all the staples. But my eyes were about that big, because what had just happened was the most real thing in my life ever. And I wanted to climb on top of a mountain and let everybody know what I had seen. I wanted to proclaim left and right that it's real. You have to understand my history. Up until 7 or 8 months before I got shot, I was a doubting Thomas. I used to say, show me one shred of evidence and I'll be a believer. And about 7 or 8 months before, I had finally given in and to faith, and I had been baptized. And I always believe to this very day that part of my reward in life for being a believer was to get that perfect witness. And it's my greatest gift, and I'm glad to share it with you, because for years I didn't share this because of all the doubting Thomases who wanted to discount what had happened to me and try to write it off for this one reason or another. And so 2 months in intensive care with nothing passing my lips, everything was fed intravenously. That is torture. The first thing they gave me when they finally believed that my internal tract would work again was beef bouillon, and it tasted like filet mignon. It was so good. My taste buds just, oh, I'm going to have nothing but beef bouillon for the rest of my life. It's so good. But then they put me out on the floor for another month and slowly but surely brought me back to using regular food, when I mean regular, soft stuff. But I had a ileostomy and a colostomy, both, while they were still trying to get everything put back together. And for the longest time, I was really extremely despondent over the fact that I didn't know whether I wanted to go on like that. It was bad enough that here I had always been the big guy, the strongest guy, that all the family members called upon to move the immovable object, and now all that had been robbed from me. Because you do not know how important your abdominal muscle is until it's gone and you can't use it anymore. Because they can sew things back together, but muscle does not grow back together. So I got out, went through recovery. By the way, when I got shot, I was this size. When they let me out of the hospital, I was 178 pounds. That's how much I had lost. But this is proof that for those of you who are dieters, there is a set point. Your body's going to make its way back no matter what. I don't care what you do for diet, you're going to make your way back to where your body wants you to be. Because I have a short racetrack now. Normally it's 24 hours for everybody. I have a 14-hour racetrack, and I still eat a lot of chow. But anyway, I got out, and it was... I knew I could never go back to the railroad because a lot of the work that I had done had been heavy industrial type stuff. I was out working on the track and swinging a maul and putting in ties and doing that kind of stuff. And so for the longest time, I was really wondering, why was I allowed to survive? Why am I here? This doesn't make sense. I'm supposed to be dead. And I'm feeling like the walking dead now because I can't see a future. I don't know what to do next. And my incredible, loving wife had a conversation with me that changed my whole attitude. And it was all about the fact that, you know, you may not be able to do some of that stuff, but here, you're still the same guy. You'll never change. That's who you are. And it brought my confidence level back, and she was right. There was a lot of things that I could continue to do. So after I was well enough to do it, I went back to school. I finished using my GI Bill. My whole life track change had gone off on a different direction because of this. How many of you are familiar with Mary Engelbert and her artwork? Are you familiar with that one where she's the little girl's at the intersection and she says, "This way, your life, this way, no longer an option"? That was the first piece of artwork my new wife, who after many years, I lost my first wife to cancer. Luckily, I found love second time around. That was the first piece of artwork we bought because both of us had come from a background where our lives were changed forever and we were taking that other pathway. But the guy who I was before getting shot and going through this experience is not the guy you see up here now. I was a former law enforcement officer who had worked on the railroad. I was rough and tough and drank too much and partied too much and did a lot of stupid things, and life changed after that forever. That experience gave me more zeal for life to do something and go out and make a difference. I went back to school. I got my master's degree in English. I became an adjunct professor of English for 18 years of my life, teaching kids to communicate who, I mean, our school system needs work in this area. But once I got my hands on them, it was great to see the headlights come on when they understood how to communicate correctly, whether writing or speaking, because I always put them through their paces. But I also went to work for the Department of Labor Veterans Employment Services because I felt serving my fellow brothers and sisters who were veterans was like a calling, because I'd always had greatest admiration for vets. So I'm a PTSD counselor as well today. I do a lot of PTSD counseling. In fact, I do national training for the Forest Service across the country for PTSD training. I deal with it. I know a lot of people are dealing with it. And it's not being a veteran is one category, but I will tell you, law enforcement officers, firefighters, abused spouses, and adult children who were abused are the other remaining large categories. So Over 15% of the population is dealing with PTSD, whether they show it or not. What I do now with the Forest Service is I'm a union representative, and I take care of all of our bargaining unit employees across the country, all of them. I'm talking 38,000 people. This is not the guy I was before getting shot in that living room. How did I take on all this responsibility? I got remarried, and I have two daughters who never would have been had that not happened. And they're two of the greatest gifts in my life. But I will tell you, the greatest after effect from what I went through, and no one can take this away from me, I came back and I have absolutely zero fear or intrepidation about death. Because I have proof in my pocket, I know something's on the other side. I got a chance to see it and came back. I've got all the insurance package I need. I'm a happy guy. I'm delighted with life. I want to go on and make a difference. Here's an example. I wouldn't have been doing this, sharing this with you people. Not that other guy. This new guy, yeah. But I know some of you in the audience have been through these near-death experiences and you're looking for answers, or you're interested in finding out how these things have common threads. I wish I could give you the plan, but I really have a belief that everybody's experience is a little bit different. When I had a chance to finally talk to I was at a Catholic hospital where I was recovering. And when the priest came to visit, I said, I have got to tell you what happened. And he says, I have heard this story so many times. And when I told him, I said, yeah, but you have to understand, he showed up just like he is in all the pictures and drawings I've ever seen. And he said, yeah. And he says, but you know what? This is from this Catholic priest. He says, if you're a black woman in South Africa, he may show up that way. If you're in Siberia, out on the plain, he may show up that way, because he's going to come to you in the most comfortable way you're going to greet and welcome him. Can you think of anything else I need to do before we Q&A? As I told you, when we were all in this valley and I had that sense of anticipation, when I came back, because he had opened his mouth and said something and brought me back to the room, the answer that was in my head was that we were waiting for the resurrection, the second coming. And that was the anticipation, that it was the redemption. We were going to wait for it to happen, and everybody is waiting for it to occur. So, did that cover it? Okay. So why don't we move into the Q&A period, and I'd be glad to answer some questions. Yes.
What was the shotgun round that was used, and how much pain did you feel? And thanks for working with vets.
You bet. Number 8 shot, there's a lot of it still inside of me. The doc told me since they had me open for 8.5 hours, that was long enough that they couldn't get everything out of there. The telltale sign I carry today is I still have 5 pieces of them in my heart. But you have to understand, this round, when it opened up, it missed my lungs. How does that happen? It missed my stomach. I still had my appendix, which took the largest part of the shot. Of course, I had a little bit of a problem with, where you turn yellow. So I had that for a while, and they fought it back. It did most of the damage to the large and small intestine, and it nicked the kidney on this side, which they had to put a stent in. And so I have high blood pressure from that, because your kidney regulates the pressure for your system. Now I get the biggest kick out of going in for any medical treatment where they have to shoot an x-ray and watching the x-ray tech walk around the screen with their eyes all lit up. What happened to you? Because there's so many... I said, if you draw a line between the dots, it makes a bunny. The pain, I will say, from the shot, I think the body floods your body with so many painkillers from your brain to override it. I didn't feel that much pain from getting shot. But boy, I can tell you, being in intensive care, it was a bear. And they were hitting me with morphine and Demerol. In fact, I have to tell you, I grew up on Warner Brothers cartoons, and I thought they were the best. But they had them on in my room when they came in and gave me a morphine and Demerol shot. I laughed my ass off. At cartoons I'd seen 100 times, they got that much more funny. So... anymore, they get you up and walk you around as soon as possible. They didn't realize that when I got shot, they were so worried about this, that when I had got hit, I'd been blown out of the chair I was in and hit the door and broke a vertebrae in the middle of my back. And so here they are getting me up out of bed, dragging me around the room with a broken vertebrae, and they don't know it. That was a lot of pain. I'm a miracle child, according to my doctor today. I don't have a lot of problems. My system works great. I can eat anything I want, drink anything I want. I just have a short racetrack.
When you were shot, you describe what happened as far as the internal organs, and you mentioned your back. But the explosiveness, the way in which the round exploded, that would be a miracle that it didn't sever your spine or do permanent damage to where you would be have other challenges in that respect.
I know. I don't believe it either. But I'm telling you, it's bizarre. Like I said, the lungs weren't hit. The stomach weren't hit. A lot of the major other organs weren't hit. The way it opened up, I don't know if there was a guiding hand, you know, or what happened. But my doctor told me that one of the major arteries in there had just gotten a tiny nick and was spurting a little bit. He said if it had just gone that much closer, he said you'd have bled out quick. So I know it's a miracle. It really is. I truly believe I'm not supposed to be here. So in being here, I need to do something with what I've been given.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think it's cool that you're courageous enough to come up here and share your story. I think near-death experience or not, that takes some guts to get up and open up to people. For those who have not been through an experience, but for those who have maybe and haven't shared that experience for whatever, what advice would you have to them? Because I feel like this is probably the 6 months I've come, and I find it so encouraging and inspiring, and it brings so much peace and hope for me who hasn't had that experience. And so what advice, if any, would you have for somebody who maybe hasn't shared their story yet?
For the longest time, I didn't share this because of all the doubting Thomases, but I started to find incident by incident where I would be talking to somebody who needed to hear what I had to share with them, and I would share in a one by one with that person, and then I felt more and more comfortable talking about it. Here's the funny thing is I'm a writer, and I've never written about it. This has almost like become oral tradition with me, talking about this. And I don't know if I could do it justice by writing it down, because I can't put the expression I'm giving to you into print or words that you're feeling emotionally. I don't think I can make that transition. But it has to be an individual choice. I would hope that if something happened to you that you felt was significant, you would want to share that, because that's a gift you really shouldn't hang on to you for yourself. How many other people can benefit from what you have been through by hearing your story? It's a gift. Share that gift. And it may take some time before you feel willing to stand up and talk in front of other people about it, but I would hope that the more you hear other people's stories, that you are encouraged to do so.
Okay. Thank you for sharing. I have a question about the perpetrator, whether he was able to get help at all.
I hope the penal system helped him. I will tell you that part of the investigation that they didn't have enough people to provide testimony that you can put in court. I had a frail 85-year-old grandmother who had just seen her son shoot her grandson, so it had messed her up badly. And my cousins who were there were too young to be put in court for testimony. So, of course, his lawyer said that he felt his life was being threatened by me, even though I'm sitting at the table and he's the only one with a gun. The judge wasn't stupid, and even though the original charge had been attempted murder with a deadly firearm, which in the state of Iowa was an automatic 10 years on top of the sentence if you used a firearm, they got a plea bargain down with assault with intent to do deadly harm. So the most the judge could throw at him was 10 years, and he gave him every year of the 10 years.
It makes sense that because of the extent of your injuries and things that you couldn't do a physical type of career anymore. I'm curious that when you came back, because most people haven't experienced that kind of trauma, they don't survive. Did you feel like there was something very important that you really needed to do? That's why you were able to come back? And if so, how did you come about finding what that thing or that you were supposed to do you ended up doing?
I'm going to tell you, I was lost. I felt like a man at sea in a boat without oars. I didn't feel like I was going anywhere. I didn't think I was going to be able to accomplish anything. For the longest time, it was like, now what? because I had depended so much on one thing in my life, and that was my physical ability. Sometimes how you get these nudges to get back on track in your life, that you get off track and something happens to get you back. My intent had always been to be in teaching. And I didn't realize it until when I went to grad school and they said, we're going to make you a teaching assistant. I said, you're going to put me in front of people where when you look at the five fearful things that people have in life, that number one above divorce or you know, death is public speaking. And yet, after I got through that very first class with that first batch of kids, wow, it was a golden burst inside me. This is terrific. I can make a difference here. And so class after class, it became more and more comfortable and more rewarding. I couldn't go the full 20 years because I couldn't read one more insipid paper and red ink it to death. I couldn't do it. I love the lecture part, but grading papers will kill you. For anybody who's been teaching, you know what I'm talking about.
David, I just wanted to actually stand here and acknowledge you, like this young lady here, because I do think it takes tremendous courage. I have been studying near-death experiences for quite some time, and I even personally wanted to experience something without the trauma. And I think that you put it beautifully, and I couldn't agree more. I've seen a common thread in what everyone has shared. And I've known several individuals who have also suffered. And I don't want to say suffer because I think that there is such a great rewarding takeaway, but a near-death experience, and have really struggled to kind of find their own purpose. And so I really just want to acknowledge you that you really did step into your purpose and living on purpose. And I know it takes recognizing that and doing a lot of your own inner workings, if you will, in order to, I think, really step into your heart and make the incredible contribution. I'm sitting here next to your lovely wife, and she's just shared how much that you really do contribute on a national level. And I just want to tell you that there's an incredible takeaway, and I realize we all have our own experience, but I think that there is an individual message for everyone with anyone's experience that we could all apply for ourselves. And, you know, for you and the way you're living your life now is a true inspiration. So I just want to acknowledge you and say thank you.
Thank you. And I'll have to say this too. Something new happens every day. I was hot tracking it to be retired by the end of this year. And we just went to our national convention for the union here last month. And I got up and talked to everybody and said, you know, you can keep me around for 4 more years if you want. Otherwise, she and I are hitting the highway to visit all the national parks. We're ready to go. And I'll be doggone, it's kind of like the mafia. You can't get out. So they elected me to general vice president, and now I take care of all the people. And you know, I used to take care of all of the bargaining unit employees for the Forest Service in Nevada, Utah, southern Idaho, and western Wyoming. Now I got everybody. 4 more years. Purpose shows itself time and again.
I just want to say, when you were there, did you feel that you wanted to stay there with your Savior? Did you feel like you didn't want to come back? And when you came back, do you feel like you want to share your life more with your Savior? Do you feel like more closer to Him and you want to have Him in your life more?
I will say first, no, I didn't have a desire to stay because I had that intent of coming back, and that no, I'm not ready yet had some intent and I needed to get back and take care of things. But I will say, I don't need man's organized dogma. I have proof of afterlife. I have proof of the existence. I don't need to be in any formal setting controlled by man, so to speak, when I have a higher understanding already. But I'm not preachy either.
You feel like you need the Savior in your life. Do you feel closer, like praying to Him and closer to Him?
When I need to? Yeah. But I feel He's with me all the time.
Yeah.
And my wife is big into prayer, and I'm glad she is because she takes care of me too quite often. But when I feel the need or the desire, I go to it. Otherwise, it's like a sense of confidence I'm walking around with already. I think part of that sense, the sense of purpose, is carried forward. Like I said, I don't share this all the time. And in fact, this is the biggest group I've ever done this to. One of the things I do for the Forest Service is fatality investigations. Not everybody can do it. A lot of people don't want to do it. But when we lose a guy out on the fire, whether it's entrapment or a tree falls on him or something, I'm willing to go. but I'm on a small team that's taking care of that. And it's traumatic for a lot of those people because they don't normally deal with fatality. I've got that experience. But that's when I feel the need that I need to talk to people about this, because they need reassurance that although this person has lost their life, there's something greater and bigger.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not preachy, but I want them to understand that this isn't the end. There's something out there beyond this. This is a waypoint.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I grew up in Iowa, I'm just having a lot of curiosity if it happened in Waterloo, because...
No. Council Bluffs.
Okay, that's close enough. And then the other question, I'm curious if the voice that you heard that said to call 911 was the same voice when you were talking to the Savior. Do you feel like they were the same person?
Yeah.
Thank you.
If somebody can explain what that might be, like I said, the best way I can explain it is if you've ever heard your voice recorded, that's what it sounded like.
Your friend had just died, but you didn't see him, just the Savior.
My friend that just died?
Had just died. You were going to his funeral.
Oh, no.
So no, only the Savior. And you,
yeah, and a number of faces and people dressed in white. I couldn't identify any of them.
But you couldn't identify any of them. Okay.
I didn't have any relatives show up or anything like that.
Okay.
I would just like to speak one word, if
oh,
I
no.
could.
Oh, no. It's my wife.
No, dear, I promise to be good.
Okay, thanks.
I just wanted to speak a word about, it's very good to get the calming sense that you get from hearing another's experience or near-death experiences. That's wonderful, and that's all individual, but there's real danger in trying to build your testimony on somebody else's experiences.
So given that you had a rough background with law enforcement and railroad, many people come back with new talents that they acquired on the other side or new insights. And I realize you've explained that you were a much different person. But have you noticed any new semi-spectacular talents? And what changed the most, your heart or your mind?
I tell you this, I wasn't a public speaker prior to all this. That's what the classroom time did for me. Whether it's the mind or the heart, I'm a much more caring person than the guy I was before. And I think my wife will tell you that I'm a lot more emotional than I used to be. Remember I told you I had to leave law enforcement because of the child fatalities. I can't deal with kids being hurt or harmed, and it tears me up. So that part of my heart is even more sensitive than it ever was before. And I think also that is in the realm of the work I do for PTSD, is I care for the people who are going through that and understand it and want to do a better job of helping to heal them in any way I can. So I don't know if how much of the mind there is involved, but it sure is a lot of heart.
Yes, I find your story quite fascinating. You mentioned that you had a hard time expressing these experiences that you had. When were you able to share this with your wife, your first wife, and how did your second wife, or wife-to-be, handle it when you shared these experiences?
My first wife took it full on. We'd always had a deep, close relationship, and when I told her what had happened, she believed me. She was right there and very supportive, thought it was wonderful and beautiful. When Leslie and I were dating, current wife, the wife, it was just something I think we started talking about while we were dating, and she was very spiritual as it was. In fact, of all the people in the room, she's probably been through the most churches or religions. I think the only thing you've got left, what, is Islam and Judaism? But anyway, she's a very spiritual person. And she understood, and it was bonding. It was very bonding.
As you've been able to share these stories, has more come to your mind? Has more been revealed to you as time's gone by?
No, I will say that what I'm sharing with you is solid, that this framework of how I've explained this to you has remained exactly the same, as clear as it ever was, unchanged, and never is altered. Because, again, it was the reality show of my life. And so it's etched into my mind deeply. as you heard it.
When you were shown this beautiful place of nature, did you experience any heightened awareness or your connection with that creation?
All of my senses were jacked. The colors, the blue was bluer than the water was. I love to go swimming, so I wanted to get in the water. I mean, it was that kind of thing. The greens, everything was just so jacked up. The air, clean, fresh. That smell of the earth and the soil. No, all the senses were really heightened. And that's why part of that sixth sense, so to speak, of picking up the anticipation, that crowd or audience feel, that was part of that sensation.
Many people, after an experience like yours, they have kind of follow-up experiences, maybe in dreams or out of body or visions of type of things. Have you experienced any of those things since your near-death experience?
I have not. And I'm kind of waiting for the next time to happen because I think that's going to be checkout time.
I found the story amazing as well, like the other gentleman said. I also found it very familiar to me. I was going to ask, since then, have you ever wanted it to happen to you, minus the circumstances like last time? Would you like that to happen to you again?
When it comes time, naturally?
Or by choice?
No, not by choice.
And I was going to ask you also, have you read the books by Robert A. Monroe?
No.
No?
No, but I'll tell you, after this happened to me, in 82, after I started to have time to lay around and I went out looking for as many books as I could on this experience because I had to understand it. And I can't tell you any of the authors, but if you go back in time to 1982, whatever the texts were out there at that time, I read as many as I could to try to figure out what the heck was going on. Because I wanted to believe everything that I'd seen, but I also wanted some explanation.
I found it really interesting when you said that the Savior had the look of pictures you'd always grown up with, and then the follow-up with the priest saying, but other people may see the Savior differently. That begs the question to me, do you feel like there are different paths that get to the same goal in life, like a religion, let's say Catholic? Would they be like one instrument in the orchestra? Is that how you look at it?
No, I don't think so. I think the way the priest had explained to me, it was pretty clear. If you think about it, and I think if you want to make the connection to relatives who have gone on before, that maybe that's part of the reveal, is that it isn't necessarily your Savior as you see it, but whoever is going to come to you is going to be the most comfortable person for you. And that's why he was saying that if you were a black lady in South Africa, it might be he'd show up as another black woman. I don't know. But it made absolute sense to me, especially people who have said that a relative has showed up to help them transition, that it's going to be the person who's most comfortable for you. And that's just my thoughts. Nothing to say that's fact or not.
I understand that's what you're saying, but I'm wondering if then there isn't just one person's view and one way to get to this goal in the life after their...
My opinion?
Yeah.
I don't think there's an exclusive club you have to be in to get there.
Great.
Thank you so much for being brave to take an experience and share with us a reality that you experience and has touched your life the rest of your life. And now you're on a new mission to share that reality. When we get that personal witness or have a personal experience, we all have that reality. I love when you said you felt your Savior came to you. Will you explain and express to us how did he show up to you? If you were to say, what color hair? What was his demeanor? What did his eyes look like? What color eyes? What was he wearing? What did he feel like to you?
Every piece of artwork you've ever seen with the robe, hair, beard, eyes, the whole bit, that's exactly what I saw. Again, it was like, wow, I've seen you before. I can associate here. I know you from someplace. That's the vision I had seen my entire life growing up in whatever text I had ever seen, and so that's how it happened. If I'd have grown up in a different area of the world, maybe it'd have been different, But the culture and the background and my life experience, that's what I associated it with. But I'm telling you, right there next to me, I don't remember being touched, but I do remember his hand coming out in the minute we were transported to that valley. And when he spoke, I didn't hear a word he said, but there was an instant sense of understanding of what he had said all appeared at once in my mind, that this was, we're waiting for the big show.
Thank you.
You bet.
I'm very intrigued and also very touched by your convenient deathbed confessional. Thanks for sharing that. Do you feel that your state of mind, your contrite heart at that point, however expedited it might have been, facilitated and allowed the rest of your experience to come to fruition?
Are you talking about the connection of getting baptized?
No, just the deathbed confessional and then the Savior being there, your Savior being there to take you by the hand. Was your state of mind, even though you're traumatized, such that you were able to take the next step and experience that personal experience with the Savior?
You know, I've never made that connection, but I'm wondering at a time like that when a person is, their mind is empty to anything else other than, am I going to live or not, would make it more inviting for something like this to happen, I think. I've never made that connection, but it makes sense.
Thank you.
You mentioned that when you were with Christ, and he touched your hand, you're in the valley, and then, as I remember, he said that Christ opened up his mouth, and then you were back in your hospital room. So I'm wondering, did he say something to you? Or was it just, it was like he was going to say something to you?
I think there was an instant understanding. He opened his mouth, and my mind was filled with what he wanted to say.
Uh-huh.
Just that quick. Like I said, my eyes were wide open. I still had the mask on my face and everything that was there,
yeah.
But boy, the feeling I had, it's like I could have risen out of that bed myself and walked away.
And you said, well, he put into your mind what he wanted to say. So was there something specific, or it was just a feeling of love?
No, I think it was an instant understanding.
Oh, instant understanding.
Yeah, he opened his mouth, and then that's when I knew that we were all waiting for the second coming.
I appreciate so much your wonderful presentation. It's been tremendous. Thank you. You had such a terrible accident, or whatever you want to call it. Do you still suffer pain or whatever from that still today?
Not directly from this, but associated pain, yeah. My wife and I talk about that. I'm dealing with pain all the time. All the time, and just have to keep it at bay. But it's different things, different parts of the body, and I don't know if it's related or the fact that I'm 63 years old and have been rough on my body.